Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight, economic warning signs. Slower job growth and rising unemployment put more pressure on the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates. Americans who were detained in Russia arrive home. We speak with the family of one of those released.
My sister and I are so over the moon and happy to have her back. It's unbelievable how much we missed her.
And the Harris campaign pivots from labeling Donald Trump a threat to democracy and leans into calling him weird.
What we're seeing here is a way to talk about this that is still on message, it's still on the theme, but there's some joy, there's some mirth, and there's some verve to it.
Welcome to the News Hour. The U.S. labor market slowed down notably last month and looked weaker than expected, creating just 114,000 new jobs. That's down significantly from the average of 215,000 jobs a month over the past year. The unemployment rate ticked up again to 4.3%. That's the highest since late 2021. The reaction to today's report is raising questions for the second time in as many days about whether the Federal Reserve has waited too long to cut interest rates. Economist Mohammed El-Aryan is among those who have been very vocal about this. He's the president of Queen's College, Cambridge University, and the chief economic advisor at Allianz, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First, a question about this jobs report. What do it and recent economic data tell you about where the economy is right now?
They tell us that the economy is weakening in a much broader and much faster rate than most people expected, including the Federal Reserve.
Is this weakening or slowdown the direct result of the Fed strategy of keeping interest rates high to fight inflation?
It is, and it was meant to slow the economy. The question is, do you get a normalization or do you get something worse? Or to use the economic language, do you get a soft landing where you sacrifice some growth, but it's worth it for bringing down inflation? Or do you get a recession where you damage Americans' well-being even more after having hit them with very high price increases? And the set of data that we've had recently, as well as what you're hearing from companies, suggests that this is beyond the normalization. So you've got two concerns right now, and you see this in the marketplace. One is about a growth scare, and the second one's about another policy mistake by the Fed.
Does this raise the specter of a recession further down the line, in your view?
So my probability for a recession is about 35%. So it's not the dominant scenario, but we've got to be careful. A recession would really damage the economy and would be particularly problematic for low-income households. They're already suffering, Jeff. They're suffering from having run down all their pandemic savings. Hiring is slowing down, their credit is maxed out. So the last thing you want to do is unduly damage the labor market, because that's the only source of income. There are no other buffers now for the low-income households.
Was the Fed late in recognizing this slowdown, this weakening, as you've described it?
Yes, and it's the second big policy mistake, in my opinion, since we've had the pandemic. The first one now is broadly recognized. They called inflation transitory when it was something much worse than that, and therefore they were slow in moving against inflation. And now I fear that they are slow in moving against economic weakness. So if they're not careful, they will end up making both mistakes in one cycle.
What kind of cut should we expect at the September meeting? Are we looking at a half point or a quarter point cut in the interest rate?
And that's what's remarkable, because as of 2-3 days ago, the narrative in the marketplace was, oh, they have time. Only a handful of us were warning that they should start immediately. Now, suddenly, the market has priced in a 70% probability of a cut by half a percentage point. Now, normally, the Fed cuts by a quarter percentage point. So if it starts with half a percentage point, that is quite a signal. My gut feeling is they won't do that, is they'll cut by a quarter percentage point, but 70% of the marketplace believes that it will be more than that.
Something in particular in this jobs report struck me and our team here. It's that those unemployed for 27 weeks or more now totaled 1.54 million people. This is the most since February of 2022. Can people hope for a significant uptick in hiring if the Fed starts making these interest rate cuts? Are the two connected?
It will take time. One of the accepted elements about monetary policy is that whether you raise interest rates or you cut interest rate, this acts with long and variable lags. So it doesn't have an immediate effect. In fact, we are still feeling the consequences of what was an enormous increase in interest rates in a very short period of time, over 5 percentage points that had to be done very quickly because the Fed fell behind. So it will take time to feel the impact of the cut. And I'm glad you focus on this point of longer-term unemployment, because what we know from history is the longer you are unemployed, the more unemployable you become. Mm-hmm. And that is a real social, economic, and political issue. So it is important that we avoid long-term unemployment going up even higher.
Mohammed El-Aryan, always a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Rarely has an airport seen such joy after very long delays, but last night was no ordinary night at Joint Base Andrews, just east of Washington, D.C. Three Americans held by Russia returned home to a presidential welcome. Nick Schifrin is here with that. Nick?
Jeff, perhaps even more important than the hugs and handshakes from the president and the vice president, the joy and the relief of the families of Evan Gershkovich, Alsu Kermasheva, and Paul Whelan, as they greeted their loved ones after months, even years, apart.
First, he had to shake the commander-in-chief's hand. But then, Evan Gershkovich got to hug his mom and lift her, as she had raised him up during his detention. Ella Millman wrote Evan every week and worked tirelessly to secure his safety for 491 days.
What about the shell support?
It's
yeah, it's overwhelming.
Paul Whelan's reunion with his sister Elizabeth took 5.5 years. She'd previously criticized President Biden for leaving her brother behind in previous trades. Overnight, the three shared a smile. And Alsu Kermasheva, after a brief vice presidential embrace, held her daughters and husband tight. They'd been separated for nearly a year while she was detained and then convicted of spreading false information. Three American families are whole again.
We're anywhere in the Oval Office.
Just hours earlier, Kermasheva's daughters and all the family members got on the president's phone.
Paul Whelan here.
I got somebody who's lived in the Oval Office. She's back. She knows the office better than I do. Go ahead, say hello, sis.
Paul, it's incredible.
There was one more call to make to Vladimir Karamurza, sentenced to 25 years for treason for his decades of journalism and pro-democracy activism that included 2 failed poisoning attempts. His work was continued by his wife, Evgenia, whom he thought he would never see again.
No word is strong enough for this. I was sure I'm going to die in prison. I don't believe what's happening. I still think I'm sleeping in my prison cell in Omsk instead of hearing your voice.
Karamurza has a green card, but traveled to Germany with the other released Russian dissidents and vowed to continue their work.
I not only believe and not only think, I know for sure that I will definitely return to Russia and that the day will definitely come when Russia will become a free, normal, civilized European country.
Ilya Yashin was also released from Russian detention as part of the swap after his conviction for spreading false information for criticizing the war in Ukraine. He said he demanded not to be freed in a prison swap that would only empower Putin.
In exchange for the release of one murderer, 16 innocent people who committed no crimes were released. This is a difficult dilemma, including because it certainly motivates Putin to take new hostages.
As for the Americans, at 2 a.m., they arrived at a rehabilitation facility in San Antonio. And after unveiling the official U.S. hostages and wrongful detainees' flag, Paul Whelan said he felt relief.
It was a good homecoming. So looking forward to seeing my family down here and just recuperating from 5 years, 7 months, and 5 days of just absolute nonsense by the Russian government.
And to talk about the Americans' return home and these emotional family reunions, I'm joined by Alsu Kirmasheva's husband, Pavel Butorin, and their older daughter, Bibi. Thank you so much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. We had you on in this studio just about 10 days ago, after Alsu had been convicted and sentenced to 6.5 years in prison for, quote, spreading falsehoods about the Russian army. And you told Amna Nawaz that day this.
No matter what we say, it doesn't adequately describe the pain that we go through every day. We wake up thinking of Alsu. We go about our day thinking about what other humiliation she's subjected to by the Russian government. We see that empty chair at our dinner table. We go to bed thinking of her, and we dream of our reunion.
10 days later, how is it to have that dream fulfilled?
Well, this is clearly a much happier occasion for us to be on PBS. It was an unbelievable day, surreal, really. We were so happy to embrace Alsu again and to welcome her back home.
Yeah, my sister and I are so over the moon and happy to have her back. It's unbelievable how much we've missed her.
Pavel, how's your wife doing?
Well, obviously, this unjust imprisonment has taken an emotional and physical toll on her well-being, and she is now receiving the medical treatment that she wasn't receiving for more than 9 months. I think she's doing okay, at least emotionally. She was obviously excited to see us. So she is in good spirits, but now this new chapter begins of her reintegrating in the free world after more than 9 months of wrongful detainment in Russia.
And may I ask, how are you doing?
Look, I'm still processing what happened yesterday. It was just unreal. Being in the Oval Office, we weren't quite prepared for that phone call. I think it came as a surprise, and when President Biden took us to his desk, and we were able to hear Alsu's voice. I was overcome with emotion, honestly. And then on the tarmac, I didn't believe it until I actually saw it. The situation was so fragile. There were so many unconfirmed single source reports. When we were on the tarmac, I think I then finally realized she's about to come out, and we will be able to once again hug Alsu.
Bibi, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm just so overwhelmed. It's so amazing hearing from everyone congratulating us on our mom's return. And we're just so very happy. And we really didn't expect this day to come so soon. And it's by far been the craziest 48 hours of my life, but in a good crazy, so really happy.
Pavel, you described how surprised you were by the phone call in the Oval Office. How surprised have you been in general over the last few days or week? Your wife was moved at some point. The three Americans were forced to sign clemency papers. You know, we were tracking that from here, but how much did you know about what was going on leading to the release?
Well, over the past several months, we've learned to keep our expectations our emotions, honestly, in check. We had some knowledge, particularly about Alsu and only about Alsu. Something that we couldn't discuss. I was a little bit disheartened by various leaks and unconfirmed reports. There was so much uncertainty about the situation. We received a phone call inviting us to the White House. Days before this whole situation, we have to keep it under wraps. And me being a journalist, it was interesting to be on the other side of the story, having some information, but not being able to share or willing to share with journalists. But it worked. It all worked out, and I'm happy it did. It just so happened that the visit almost coincided with our tickets to a Taylor Swift show, and So we're a little bit conflicted. We're not quite sure what we're going to do. But, we ended up missing that show. But, I hope we'll make it one day.
I have a feeling that if we publicize this interview and you said that you missed a Taylor Swift show in order to meet Alsu as she was released, I have a feeling that someone might reach out to you with a little bit of help for tickets.
I hope so. Yeah, I think we have a new campaign underway right now, don't we?
Pavel, may I ask one other question, too? You know how important your wife's work was in Russia. Do you think that she would ever be willing to go back?
We'll just have to wait and see. She is in a fragile state right now. She needs recuperation and readjustment. So we look forward to guiding her and to, you know, providing our assistance in that process.
You say she's in a fragile state. What kind of state did you get the sense that she was in when you were talking to her?
I think it's apparent that she has lost some weight. You know, she needs to, you know, get some nutritionist advice, I think. Get back into her, you know, exercise routine. We're a family of runners, you know, but we're there to support her. We know that, you know, and she knows that her friends and her family are very much ready to support her every step of the way.
Well, she definitely feels that support, and hopefully she feels the world's support as we all cover her homecoming and your reunion. So, Pavel and Bibi, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
New information about the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump starts the day's other headlines. Acting Secret Service Director Ronald Rowe said today that his agents were not on the same radio system as local law enforcement on the day of the shooting. That cost valuable time when local police warned via radio that there was an armed assailant on the roof of a building outside the security perimeter. This afternoon, Rowe told reporters his agency takes full responsibility. That's after he partially blamed local law enforcement during congressional testimony earlier this week.
This was a Secret Service failure, and so they should not be blamed. There was somebody who did, in fact, radio out that they had seen the individual with a weapon. What I can tell you is that piece of information, that vital piece of information, and by no fault of anyone, it was a very stressful situation. It did not make it over.
Rowe said he'll consider having Secret Service inside what's called the Unified Command Post, which is operated by local authorities at all times going forward to ensure better communication. Turning abroad now to Venezuela's disputed presidential election, the Biden administration has now officially recognized Nicolas Maduro's challenger, that's opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez, as the winner. Other countries, including Argentina, Ecuador, and Costa Rica, have done the same. It all comes as a fellow opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, said masked men ransacked her party's headquarters overnight. That raid follows threats by top officials, including from Maduro himself, that he would arrest his political rivals. Maduro has yet to produce evidence of his claimed victory. Mourners held a funeral for slain Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh today, days after he was assassinated in Tehran. Attendees prayed over Haniyeh's coffin at the National Mosque in Qatar, where he'd lived for the last several years. Palestinians in Jerusalem also mourned his death. Haniyeh was a main negotiator for Hamas and ceasefire talks with Israel. Last night, President Biden said the assassination was not helpful for negotiations, and he urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to act quickly.
I'm very concerned about it. I had a very direct meeting with the Prime Minister today, and very direct. We have the basis for a ceasefire. He should move on it, and they should move on it now.
Meantime, Hezbollah resumed rocket and artillery fire against Israel today. It ended a pause in these cross-border strikes following Israel's killing of a top Hezbollah commander in Beirut this week. The leading global authority on food security has officially declared a famine in the Darfur region of Sudan, where more than 500,000 people have fled from the spiraling violence of that country's civil war. Special correspondent Leila Molana Allen has this report from inside Sudan.
I'm in Port Sudan, which is the Sudanese government's wartime capital after the capital Khartoum was seized last year by the Rapid Support Forces militia. And after weeks of dire warnings, the World Food Programme says it has found evidence of famine in Zamzam camp in North Darfur, where around 200,000 displaced people live, and immediate risk of famine in 14 other areas of Sudan. That means that over 20% of people in those areas are at immediate risk of starvation, malnutrition, and death. If nothing is done by September, millions of people in Sudan could be facing full famine, which would be the greatest famine of recent decades. The Sudanese armed forces and the government say there is no famine anywhere in Sudan, and they deny claims that they have been stopping aid crossing posts into RSF territory. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Leila Milana Allen in Port Sudan.
Today, both the UN and USAID led renewed calls for a ceasefire so that humanitarian assistance could get through. Aid workers haven't been able to get supplies to the destitute camps in Darfur since April. Back in the U.S., the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission have sued TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance. They claim the social media app violates online privacy by failing to seek parental consent before collecting data on children under the age of 13. In a statement, TikTok said it offers, quote, age-appropriate experiences with stringent safeguards. On Wall Street, the poor jobs numbers today sent stocks into a free fall over investor concerns that the economy could be weakening. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeted over 600 points, the NASDAQ dropped by over 2%, and the S&P 500 lost 100 points. And a spoiler alert, we have the latest from today's action at the Paris Olympics. One of Team USA's star sprinters, Sha'Carri Richardson, made her first Olympic strides today, breezing through her opening heat of the 100 meters. Americans also secured a spot in the final for the 4x400-meter mixed relay, breaking the world record along the way. In the pool, Léon Marchand of France extended his dominant swimming streak with a fourth gold in front of a home crowd. But it's Team USA who leads the medal count at the end of week one, with 43 medals overall. Still to come on the NewsHour, Jonathan Capehart and Eliana Johnson analyze the busy week of news at home and abroad. A new book looks at the fascinating true story of a formerly enslaved man who was crucial to creating Jack Daniel's whiskey. And poetry comes to the national parks.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Democratic National Committee announced today that Vice President Kamala Harris has secured the number of delegates in a virtual roll call to win the party's nomination, which will be made official after voting ends on Monday. While on the campaign trail, the vice president is trying some new language on for size, like calling her opponent Donald Trump weird. Our White House correspondent Laura Barrón-López has more.
On a fast-track campaign for the White House, Vice President Harris is trying something new, to call it as she sees it.
He and his running mate sure seem to have a lot to say about me. And by the way, don't you find some of their stuff to just be plain weird?
It's a notable change from when President Biden was in the race.
Do you really want to go back to the chaos of Donald Trump as president?
Much of his language focused on Donald Trump as an existential threat to the country.
It's about your freedom. It's about democracy.
Now, campaign press releases call Trump old and quite weird. And Democrats across the board are leaning into Harris's blunt approach. From possible vice presidential picks commenting on Trump's behavior.
Have you ever seen the guy laugh? If he has laughed, it's at someone, not with someone. That is weird behavior.
To leaders of the party addressing resurfaced clips of J.D. Vance.
Every day, Vance has done something more extreme, more weird, more erratic.
Branding the Republicans as creepy has caught on fast.
That's just the start.
In an ad released by a PAC focused on young voters, the conservative playbook Project 2025 is personified as people desperate to control your personal life.
Your genitals are reserved for procreation.
If you freeze 12 eggs, you should be required to have 12 babies, or else you're a serial killer. And I'm definitely not a serial killer.
Are you?
This shift in language is a strategy that could prove effective as Harris rushes to define her opponent in a new way, according to David Karp of George Washington University.
The serious messaging around Donald Trump that this is a threat to democracy if we take him both seriously and literally this time, that's important, but it's also a bummer. And what we're seeing here is a way to talk about this that is still on message, it's still on the theme, But there's some joy, there's some mirth, and there's some verve to it.
Since Democrats have changed their tune, rhetorically, Republicans have tried to find a response. Former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy said Democrats are being dumb and juvenile. While Donald Trump tried to use Harris's words against her in a recent interview with Fox News.
You know who's playing weird? She's playing weird. She's a weird person. Look at her past.
But for Republican strategist Joshua Novotny, based in the key battleground state of Pennsylvania, Donald Trump should stay focused on attacking Harris's record.
Stay off the personal stuff and you know, talk about how she mismanaged the border crisis, talk about the inflation and the economy. I don't think anyone is sitting there saying, you know, we enjoy paying twice as much for our groceries than we did a couple years ago. Those are winning issues here. I would ignore the weird comments and all of that. I think that will backfire on Democrats as being a little too mocking and childish and kind of beneath them.
Donald Trump is no stranger to name-calling, recently saying Harris is dumb as a rock, demonizing her on the campaign trail.
She has no clue. She's evil.
And even mocking her biracial heritage.
She was Indian all the way, and then all of a sudden she made a turn, and she became a black person.
Just to be clear, sir, Trump's reactions are another sign the weird attack is landing, Karp said.
Part of the reason we know this is working well isn't just that it's going viral online, but that it has her opponents stuttering in response and saying it's not fair. When you have your opponents reacting in ways that amplify your message and make them uncomfortable, you keep on doing that.
When we fight, we win!
Michelle Obama's "When they go low, we go high" may no longer be Democrats' North Star, but it's a choice that could end up boosting Harris's self-described underdog campaign. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone-Lopez.
On the major political stories shaping the week, we turn to the analysis tonight of Capehart and Johnson. That's Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, and Eliana Johnson, editor-in-chief of The Washington Free Beacon. David Brooks is away this evening. Hello, hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
So Kamala Harris has passed the threshold to clinch the Democratic presidential nomination in this virtual vote of party delegates. This is the same day that the campaign says it raised $310 million in July. This is the biggest haul of the 2024 cycle, more than double what Donald Trump's campaign and the RNC raised in the same month. Jonathan, it was far from a guarantee that Democrats would remain as united and as energized as they have been since VP Harris emerged atop the ticket. What do you make of this launch of hers and this historic fundraising haul?
Well, the launch is pretty spectacular. I remember sitting here and saying, if Joe Biden needs to be the top of the ticket, and if he's not the top of the ticket, and it's not Vice President Harris, Democrats are going to lose. And I said that because there were people talking, there were moves afoot to leapfrog over the sitting vice president for someone else. That did not happen. And I think the way the vice president comported herself through all of this spoke well of her, the team around her commitment to the president. And I think that once the president endorsed her, which was very, very important, The level of enthusiasm went from 0 to 1,000 in a nanosecond. And we see, you know, according to the Supreme Court, money is speech. So $310 million raised in just in the month of July, but the bulk of it in the last 10 days, that says something. The Democratic Party is energized. They're thrilled. And her campaign speeches and her events show that it's not just that they're... like you got a new candidate, but there's some passion behind her.
And Eliana, for Donald Trump, I mean, he's now facing criticism for falsely claiming that Kamala Harris misled voters about her race. He's also having to defend his vice president, J.D. Vance, who's being scrutinized for past comments he made disparaging childless women. You know, the vice president has a real record that Republicans could scrutinize, but Donald Trump keeps reverting to these race and gender-based attacks. Why are he and his campaign struggling to find a line of attack that sticks?
One thing on the Democrats before that is, in terms of uniting the party and getting people excited, it helps not to have a primary where Democratic candidates were pummeling each other, which they managed to avoid. In terms of Trump, yes, he's veering off into bizarre spaces. And what the Trump campaign needs to do, why is he doing it? He's not a particularly disciplined messenger. I don't think anybody's particularly surprised to see this. They need to settle on one message and one line of attack against Kamala Harris, whether it's that she's a San Francisco liberal whose views are out of touch and to the left of those of the average American, or that she's flip-flopped and changed every position she held that she ran on in 2019. And so, you know, if they do that, they can say she doesn't believe in anything. She's willing to say anything in order to be elected president, but pick one and hammer it home every day. I'm sure that is what Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, Trump's campaign managers, are telling him to do. But Trump is Trump. You know, he's the same candidate he's always been.
And Jonathan, Democrats say that they've learned their lesson from 2016, that now when Donald Trump attacks, they try to respond aggressively, but they use his attacks to reemphasize their own message. Are we seeing more of that?
We are. Well, here's the thing about the vice president and her campaign's responses to the racism and misogyny coming from Donald Trump. She gives it maybe one line in any of her campaign speeches, and she moves on to talking about the Biden-Harris record and then what a Harris administration would do if she's entrusted with the presidency. So they're not paying attention. They're not giving it undue oxygen to keep it going. And so I think they're doing what they need to do. Meanwhile, on the social media side, however, they're all over it. I mean, so many memes, so many little videos that the young people can share where the campaign is responding to the ridiculousness, particularly from NABJ, with, you know, Donald Trump saying she turned black, which has set off a whole meme on its own. Yeah.
Well, we expect that the vice president could name her running mate anytime this weekend, certainly by Tuesday, when she and her running mate are expected to have their first appearance in Philadelphia. And I'm told that she has settled, she's narrowed her list of finalists to these six. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and of course, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. So this is according to two sources familiar. Eliana, the conventional wisdom has always been that a VP pick doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. Is that different in this election cycle?
I think it could be, in that Harris has a more difficult road to hoe in the Electoral College. And so if I were her, Harris' campaign is not asking me for advice, I would pick someone who could help me win. And some of these candidates could help her marginally, given that they come from states that are very competitive. Mark Kelly in Arizona, though I think he has too much personal baggage. He had a very testy divorce in 2004. And Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. And for that reason, I think those two are probably the front runners. My money would probably be on Shapiro, but I have no special insight into this process.
Jonathan, do you have special insight into this process?
I have no special insight into this process, but I will say, I mean, every 4 years we talk about, well, the vice presidential pick doesn't really matter. But tell that to John McCain. And in 2008, where Sarah Palin looked real great. I was in the hall when she gave the hockey mom speech and thought, ooh, Obama's going to have some issues here. And then within a couple of weeks, completely imploded. And so the vice presidential pick, it does have an impact, as Donald Trump is seeing.
I actually don't agree with that on Palin, though. I think Palin actually helped the McCain ticket, even though in retrospect people think, oh, she was a total moron. I think McCain got more votes with Palin on that ticket because she excited women at the time than he otherwise would have gotten.
Initially, but come on, a couple Katie Kirk interviews, Charlie Gibson, she didn't know anything.
I don't think she heard him.
Well, as we end our conversation, I want to talk about the fact that Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan were among those, you know, two dozen detainees released as part of the biggest prisoner exchange between Russia and the West since the Cold War. Lasting takeaways. President Biden said that it was a feat of diplomacy.
Yeah, not bad for an 82-year-old man. Everyone said had cognitive decline and were questioning his mental acuity. When you read what was the TikTok of what happened in the Wall Street Journal, that man was all over it. This was a huge diplomatic feat, but this was also a huge victory for the United States and for the American people. To bring those Americans home is something that should be universally celebrated.
And the detail that he was on the phone with his Slovenian counterpart, basically coordinating this deal, just an hour before he announced that he wouldn't seek re-election. I mean, how does that strike you?
Well, that example is something that, you know, when I've interviewed the president twice, and in both interviews, I came away with one really distinct impression. He loves that job. And the fact that he's got all of this stuff going on, but he is on the phone trying to make a deal, that's why he wants to be president. That's why he loves the job. It's about getting something done.
Eliana?
It's wonderful that they're home. However, we need to stop doing deals where we trade terrorists and assassins for reporters and dissidents. And what dictator wouldn't take more hostages to make that deal? And in order to do that, we need to impose serious consequences on the hostage-taking nations. And that is not something I have seen from the Biden administration. If we continue to do deals like this, we will find more Americans behind bars unjustly detained in despotic nations.
Eliana Johnson and Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jack Daniel's is a famous American whiskey brand recognized all over the world. But Jack Daniel didn't create the particular method for distilling Tennessee whiskey. He learned it from a formerly enslaved man named Nearest Green, the first known African-American master distiller. Back in 2016, Fawn Weaver was traveling abroad with her husband when she read a New York Times article about Nearest Green. That article set Fawn on a mission to learn more about him. She would go on to create Uncle Nearest Premium Whiskey to honor and preserve Green's legacy. 7 years after launching, Fawn Weaver now owns the most successful black-owned liquor empire, worth more than $1 billion, led by an all-women executive team. Fawn Weaver shares Nearest Green's story and her own journey in her new book, Love in Whiskey, the remarkable true story of Jack Daniel, his master distiller Nearest Green, and the improbable rise of Uncle Nearest. I recently sat down with her. Fawn Weaver, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
The story of Nathan Nearest Green, Uncle Nearest to his family and friends, is one of the most remarkable and until recently little-known American stories. How did you first encounter it, and why did it resonate so deeply with you?
It was on the cover of the New York Times International Edition. You have this photo that is on the cover of Jack Daniel. I didn't drink Jack Daniel, but I knew what he looked like. I think we all know what he looked like. And there was a black man seated to his right. And the headline was, Jack Daniels embraces a hidden ingredient, help from a slave. Well, I think every black person in this country was fascinated by that, because we've known that we've been at the beginning of so many brands, trademarks we couldn't trademark, patents we couldn't patent. And I think we're still, as a group of people, very curious about, well, what were the things that we were involved in the beginning that we had at least some type of assist with, or what did we invent and we didn't know? And so I think that that's important, that we're just all learning that.
And that picture, which is on the cover of the book, this black man is not Uncle Nearest, it's his son, George.
Yes.
But this picture became the basis of a false narrative.
It did.
And the false narrative was that Jack Daniel owned slaves, that he stole the recipe from Uncle Nearest and claimed all the credit.
Yes.
And it became part of your mission, ultimately, in correcting that story.
And cleaning that up. The amount of time that I and my team spent literally calling newscasters and saying, hey, you got this story wrong. Can you take that down? We'll give you the true story. And the reason I thought that was important is you have this man, this white man, that by all accounts may have been our first ally. And he was absolutely being torn apart in the press, and he was one of the people who actually stood up for us. And I said, no, we can't allow this to happen, that finally we have a story that comes forward, and it's a good American story, and both people involved, black and white, were incredible people. I can't allow one of them to be torn down just because of his race.
Because Uncle Nearest was actually a mentor to Jack Daniel.
Absolutely he was.
Yeah. There are so many inflection points in your story, Fawn, but the one that resonated with me, that struck me deeply, was you and your husband were living in Los Angeles at the time, and you took this trip to Lynchburg, Tennessee. You planned to be there for 4 days to continue doing your research. But along the way, you find this farm, and you decide to buy it.
Yeah.
And you move from L.A. to Lynchburg, but that is when all of the doors started opening.
Absolutely. And let me be clear. We didn't find the farm. It was Jack Daniels, one of his descendants, his now eldest living descendant, who said to me, you know that farm that you read about in the book? And she was referring to his biography, Jack Daniels' Legacy. Most of that takes place on this farm. It's where we now know the original Jack Daniels distillery was birthed. It is where Jack Daniels distillery number 7, that's where it was. And it's where Jack grew up and all the rest of that stuff. And she said, you realize it's for sale. I mean, this is all happening in a matter of hours of us showing up in Lynchburg, Tennessee. And so that's where it all began. And then obviously when we decided we were going to buy this 313-acre farm, and now we have this task of restoring the home where Jack grew up and restoring where the original stream area was that led into the distillery and all the rest of that stuff, and excavating the grounds to find all the historical elements and then putting it on the historical registry. So at that point, that 4 days turned into a lifetime.
Well, fast forward, with the support of Green's descendants,
yes,
you launched this company less than 10 years after launching. It now has a billion-dollar valuation. Mm-hmm. It's the best-selling Black-owned spirits brand in the world, mm-hmm, led by an all-female executive team. Mm-hmm. A huge success. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, mm-hmm, how did the parent company of Jack Daniels respond to this research that you were doing and this plan to launch a company around Uncle Nearest?
In the beginning, it was very interesting with their company, in part because you had people who saw immediately, okay, we have a problem, which is everyone now thinks that our namesake was a slave owner, that he stole the recipe, hid the slave, and we can't clean this up. And so this woman has now done all of this research. She's gathered thousands of documents from 6 different states, done over 100 interviews, and she can actually clean this up. So on one side, you had probably half of the company that was like, listen, just let her do what she's doing because it benefits us. Mm-hmm. Then you had the other half of the company that could not get out of their way because they couldn't wrap their head around the fact that they were allowing what they considered a competitor to emerge, and that was tied so closely to their brand. And this went on for years.
Wow. I know you get asked all the time how you as a Black woman confront the challenges you face in the spirits industry dominated by white men, but I want to flip that question on its head.
Please do.
How do you, being the exception, mm-hmm, use that different perspective, mm-hmm, the different entry point, mm-hmm, the different point of view,
yeah,
the different approach,
yeah,
to benefit your business?
So I love that you switched it, because that would have just been my answer.
Okay.
And the reason it would have been my answer is that I've been in this industry now for 7 years. I have seen more white males fail than any other race or gender. And so I looked at me coming in as a person of color, as a woman, as a Black woman, I looked at that as an advantage. It's the same advantage, I believe, just being an American. When I walk into a room full of billionaires, just because it's a room full of billionaires, it's majority white male. Well, who do you think they remember at the end of that time in that room?
Hmm.
And so I have always seen being a Black woman in America as an advantage. I think it's all a matter of mindset. How do you look at it? How do you position it? When you walk into a room, are you uncomfortable to be in that room because no one looks like you? For me, I've always looked at it and said, if I walk into a room and no one looks like me, then that means everybody's looking at me. So I have the greatest advantage in that room.
That there is this ubiquitous American brand,
yeah,
known all around the world.
Yeah.
That there was this Black man, Nearest, mm-hmm, Green, at the very beginning of it, mm-hmm, and that you are the steward of his namesake. What does that feel like, Fawn?
I don't want to call it a weight or a burden, because it is such a blessing and it's such an honor, but it comes with enormous responsibility. I'm in the middle of my book tour, and every place that we've gone to, sold out events, and the lines are super long. And I can tell you, I can't even count the number of people who come up to me with tears in their eyes because of what I represent to them. If I could do this in the whiskey industry, in the bourbon industry, where before me there was no one that wasn't a white male, if I could do that in that industry, then they can do it in tech, they can do it in investment, they can do it in banking, they can now see themselves doing it. That is a huge responsibility, because my success gives them belief and gives them hope that they can do it as well.
Fawn Weaver, co-founder of Uncle Nearest Premium Whiskey and the author of Love and Whiskey. Thanks so much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
There's a new year-long project by the nation's poet laureate bringing poetry in the natural world into focus and what's at stake due to climate change. Jeffrey Brown reports for our new series, Art in Action, exploring the intersection of art and democracy. It's part of our Canvas coverage.
It was a walk in the park with poetry. National Park Service Ranger Alusha Scott leading, then reading the work of poet Mary Oliver.
Look. The trees are turning their own bodies into pillars.
Oliver, who died in 2019, was known for her love of nature, and this was one of her favorite walks, around Blackwater Pond on the Cape Cod National Seashore in Massachusetts. Taking that walk this day, one of today's leading poets, U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limone, launching a project she calls You Are Here.
I kept thinking that poetry and nature are the two things that works so beautifully together to bring us a sense of awe and wonder. Mm-hmm. And I feel like poetry is a way that opens us up to a deeper experience with nature. And so the two of them working together is really beautiful.
Please join me in welcoming our 24th United States Poet Laureate, Ada Limone.
One part of You Are Here is poetry in the parks, bringing classic nature poems by past writers into the natural world itself.
One, two, three, poetry.
Limone chose to kick off the campaign here in Cape Cod with Mary Oliver's poem, Can You Imagine?, printed atop a picnic table, a place for all who come here to read, contemplate, perhaps to write something of their own.
I really wanted to offer a moment of reflection and deeper intention in the parks.
What does poetry do?
Poetry sort of ignites a place in you that is receptive to a deeper kind of attention. And a poem, sitting and reading a poem, even a very short one, can allow you to receive the world in a different way.
That was certainly the impact the Pulitzer Prize-winning Oliver, one of the country's most read and best-loved poets, had on many, including Limone, who was eager to honor her here.
She famously used to hide pencils in the beech forest so that if she had a good idea and was without a pen, she could find one of those pencils and make sure she could write it down.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's an interesting kind of littering. Poetic litter.
Poetic pencil litter.
To live in this world, you must be able to do three things.
But Poetry in the Parks, a collaboration with the Poetry Society of America, and notably the National Park Service, is also about a far more serious impact on the world around us, the destructive forces of climate change. Ranger Clay Hanna works in interpretation and engagement at the national headquarters.
Yeah, when we think about our national parks, we see those impacts of climate change, right? We see that directly within our parks. And I think a project like this is another way to approach communication about what's happening to the natural world, right? And connecting that through a different means, through poetry, allows visitors to immerse themselves, find themselves in these landscapes, and think about how they have a connection to the natural world.
The project brings Limone into seven national parks around the country, featuring significant American poems relating to each.
This is another dear poet and poem.
She read the seven poems at Provincetown's Fine Arts Work Center, including The Valley by Jean Valentine.
The Valley, edge by edge.
For Cuyahoga National Park in Ohio. The Earth is a Living Thing by Lucille Clifton. For Great Smoky National Park in Tennessee and North Carolina.
The earth is a living thing, is a black, shambling bear.
Cloud Song by Ophelia Zepeda for Arizona's Saguaro National Park.
Greenly they emerge, in colors of blue they emerge.
The other piece of Limone's You Are Here project requires no visits to the great outdoors.
She commissioned new work for an anthology from contemporary poets addressing our lives as part of nature. Her goal, a new kind of nature poetry, reflecting traumatic changes for millions and for the earth itself.
Now, when we write about nature, there's solastalgia that's connected to it. There is sadness, there's worry, there's anxiety, mm-hmm. there's tension.
Solastalgia?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's basically being nostalgic for a place that you are in at the moment because you know it's shifting and changing. And I'm not quite sure how clear-eyed our poetry can be if we're not making room for our whole selves and those parts of us that are grieving, those parts of us that are furious, and those parts of us that are trying to figure out how to make impactful change.
The You Are Here project also includes a kind of call to action via social media to encourage people to share their poetic responses to the prompt and to build a community of concerned citizens. Back at the park, Ranger Clay Hanna refers to the idea of democracy for all in describing the role of storytelling in the parks using poetry and other arts.
We see parks as a place for people to come together, right? Our programming is audience first. We're audience centered, right? So we're not telling people how to think. We're providing those stories to make them think, right? And often to interact with each other.
In an unusual partnership, Ada Limon collaborated with government climate scientists, studying their findings and contributing a poem to an official report. For Limon, there is the ultimate belief in the power of her art form to impact lives, even at a time like this.
Because it feels to me like we can get very myopic and feel like we are the only person going through whatever it is that we're going through. And in reality, all of us need to recognize that what happens in this world happens to all of us.
One, two, three.
After our time together, Ada Limon took her project to Mount Rainier National Park in Washington and Redwood National and State Parks in California. Her park visits continue through the fall. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Cape Cod National Seashore in Provincetown, Massachusetts.
And in October, Ada Limon will send some of her poetry into outer space. Her poem, In Praise of Mystery, is being engraved onto the Europa Clipper spacecraft, set to take off for its 1.8 billion mile mission to Jupiter's smallest moon. The so-called Message in a Bottle project invited people around the world to sign on to the poem. Some 2.6 million will now have their names stenciled onto microchips mounted on the spacecraft. As always, there's a lot more online at pbs.org/newshour, including a story about a backlog in Missouri holding up state subsidies for more than 1,800 child care providers that help keep their doors open. And be sure to tune into Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight for a look at yesterday's historic prisoner exchange and the latest on the presidential race. And on PBS News Weekend, following Donald Trump's comments about Kamala Harris's race, a look at the history of identity and its role in American politics. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.